The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 5 already of this 7-day session, and actually we're most of the way through day 5 already. So it's been a very strong session, which means that it can get even stronger. This is very important to keep plugging away even more so, because you have greater capacity today than you did yesterday or the day before or the day before, or even the morning of session, or even during the metta hour. So take advantage of that. It really, really is amazing. It may not feel like it sometimes. We may feel like our mind is going everywhere but deep into the practice. But that's actually the best time to practice anyway. So go for it. Throw caution to the winds and go for it. Take the risk. It can seem like a very big risk that you'll actually disappear. And in one sense, that is true. In another sense, who you think you are will disappear. But who you really are will come forth and make itself known to you. And that is worth reaching. Today I'd like to share some more of the teachings of Keido Fukushima, the head abbot of Tofukuji Monastery until he died in 2011. One of the last of the Rinzai masters, the true masters. There are still Rinzai teaching temples in Japan, and one notable one is that of Sogenji, where there is also a true master there. And to be true, Fukushima Roshi did leave at least one Dharma successor, a Westerner, Jeff Shore, who has lived in Japan many, many years, decades really, and is married to a Japanese woman and teaches at Hanazono University. And at a certain point, well before he died, Fukushima Roshi started referring his English-speaking and foreign students to Jeff. And Jeff has continued to train people in that same tradition. He has a little zendo at his home in Kyoto. The teachings today from the book Zen Bridge, the Zen Teachings of Keido Fukushima, edited by Grace and Peter Shireson, a husband and wife team who had actually trained with Fukushima Roshi, and it is their recordings that form the basis of this book, the recordings of his talks and their encounters with him that they edited and put into this book, which is well worth reading. Today's topic is Zen and Compassion, according to the title of the chapter. It's chapter 5 in the book. But it really is about the deepest level of compassion. And that comes from letting go a tenacious idea of who we are and seeing clearly our habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion, and working to let them go, these attachments. They cause us an incredible amount of suffering, really. They are the source of suffering, these attachments. But as we do our zazen, that extended out breath in particular, it requires letting go. And it trains us, and it alters our brain, really, so that we are less and less attached to certain kinds of things. And we become more clear and we're able to see where we are attached and where our behavior really is not necessarily exemplary of the Bodhisattva vow. There's a little sentence that is at the very beginning of this chapter. It says, transcending dualism doesn't mean doing away with dualistic discrimination. It means doing away with right and wrong from a self-centered perspective. All Buddhism, including Zen, leads practitioners to enter the world with great compassion. To become a priest without any social sense is not good. Zen is not separate from society. Zen is concrete and based in daily life. All great religions ask us to live with great compassion, and it's quite natural and good for Zen practitioners to oppose war and meet social problems with compassion. Monks eventually come to understand this as a result of their training. After constantly stripping away your own egotism, you develop compassion for others. It arises naturally. Those who sincerely engage in training develop in such a way. And in a certain way, we yearn to develop in that way. Otherwise, I don't think we'd stick out the practice, because the practice is challenging and not necessarily easy. It can be frustrating, it can be discouraging, it can be difficult. We're sort of blindly going along, and we don't really have much of a guidebook, because it's impossible, really, to provide much of a guidebook. I wish it were possible to say, okay, you do this first, and then you just do this next, and then you do this next, and so on and so forth, and eventually you come to awakening. And all we can do is kind of point a way. We can teach people how to do Zazen. We can help guide people in mastering the extended out-breath and encourage people to continue using that incredibly valuable and effective practice to deepen their awareness and to begin to let go of greed, anger, and delusion, any stickiness that may be attached to through conditioning, through assumptions, through this tenacious self-image. But we can't do much more than that. We can say, hey, if it feels difficult right now, that's exactly the best time to practice. Your mind doesn't want to focus on anything, that's fine. Just keep trying. It will make a big difference. Feeling like you could care less about practice? See what you can do to regain that interest. Practice anyway. Practice anyway. Often, if we lose interest in practice, it's because something has come up that we're not quite ready to see, not quite ready to open to. Some hidden conditioning, some hidden experience that is too painful or too unpleasant, and we don't want to open to it. And we keep using the out-breath, the extended out-breath, to kind of nibble around at it. We can also use the technique that Eugene Gendlin came up with decades ago, which is called focusing. And focusing actually, he didn't really come up with it. This is actually a fundamental basis of Zen practice, to focus on the total experience of the moment. And as we extend the out-breath, reaching, we don't even know what we're reaching for. This is the blindness that requires the faith that is one of the three pillars of Zen. But if we can only get the breath out so far, then that means something's going on. And we tune in to the felt sense of that, can't get it any further than, you know, the top of my chest. And as we continue to tune in, to embrace that physical experience again and again, we will usually end up with an insight into what is causing the situation. It may take a while for it to come forth, but if we persist, eventually it will. And while it may not be something that we would like to see, seeing it is an enormous step forward in being able to let go. So take heart. If there are negative experiences that seem to come up for you as you're practicing, tune in. That's the way to work with them and to allow them to dissolve. We're not trying to push anything away, and we're certainly not trying to push it back in its box. As we let go more and more, our innate compassion does come forth, and it's more active because it's more free, because it's not constrained by the self-image. And we may find ourselves doing and saying things that surprise us as a result, but they will always be in the direction of compassion and good. He continues, there's sunny weather and rainy weather. Transcending dualism doesn't do away with rainy days. Instead, you dress appropriately for warm weather and take an umbrella when it rains. Sometimes it's warm and then it's cold and then it's raining. And like today, sometimes it's a blizzard and we have almost a foot of snow. Now the sun is out and it's melting the snow rather rapidly. And once it gets down to a certain point, we're going to have a sea of mud, so beware of that. Sometimes people complain about the weather, but I don't think anything of it. Zen is a religion that teaches us how we should live appropriately here and now, just as ourselves. When the weather's cold, we should respond to the cold. If it's cold, I should wear a scarf. And when it rains here and now, I should bring an umbrella. Transcending dualism means to adapt within discrimination and dualism to see both sides. Zen teaches this kind of transcendence, and this teaching includes freedom from attachments. And this is why the practice is so important, because as we extend that out-breath far enough that we have to increase the focus and the concentration in order to do it, we are actively practicing letting go. And that letting go extends naturally, without our trying to do anything about it, to any attachments we have. It's an incredible practice. Zen teaches this kind of transcendence, and this teaching includes freedom from attachments. When there's conflict, you treat good as good and bad as bad. The path to attaining no ego is the religious person's path. Dealing with conflict before attaining no ego is difficult because we put ourselves first. We see conflict subjectively in terms of our own situation, our own interests. If our egos are active, something that's essentially bad may feel to us as if it's good, because we have a self-centered perspective. And again, the more we do this extended out-breath practice, the more clearly we begin to see where perhaps we've been mistaken in our attitudes. This is all part of what Hakuin and Tore Enji, his premier student, felt was vital in practice. This what they call the long maturation, where we are living our increasing awareness and depth and let-go-ness. There are so many people who have gone through years and years of Zen practice, concentrating only on solving koans, doing nothing about their behavior or about integrating what they might have realized in their minds into their behavior. And so they're still behaving the same ways they were before they ever had any kind of Zen practice. And it's often relatively dysfunctional. Straightforward bravery is an expression that Hawking came up with in terms of looking into our own mind and doing our practice with straightforward bravery. Because, as I said earlier, we're going to see things we're not necessarily liking to see. But in order to let them go, these dysfunctional habit patterns of behavior, thought and speech, we have to see them. If we're oblivious to them, how can we do anything about letting them go? So the first and vital stage is to see them. And it's a stage in Zen practice, an ongoing stage in Zen practice, which initially can feel quite daunting. But once we realize the incredible benefit of being able to see these places where we're caught, we are quite happy when we do see them, because we know it's a chance to let them go. Fukushima Roshi continues, "Of course, there are Zen priests who go through the training, yet remain egotistical. When a monk is still in the monastery, the master can see his egotism, warn the monk, and work with him on it." I would add, if the monk is willing to do that. Often the monk, if he's too attached to his self-centered opinions, he will simply leave the monastery, at least in America. And I've seen it happen in different places that I've trained. In Japan, however, where there's a great culture of community, and the community is also invested in this monk's training, if the monk gets discouraged or angry or whatever and wants to quit, the community will come forth and say, "Wait a minute, you made this commitment during your ordination. You have to keep it." So it's a little bit different in Japan. Here, we Westerners like our independence. We like to do what we want to do when we want to do it. "Don't fence me in." Isn't that on some license plate in some states? But the real no fences is when we are completely let go. And that we can achieve through our Zen practice. If we're willing to give ourselves fully to it in an ongoing manner for a very long time and never stop training, really. When a monk is still in the monastery, the master can see his egotism, warn the monk, and work with him on it. But there are those cases where, without doing away with his ego, a monk leaves the monastery to assume the role of a lone priest of a small temple. One monk I know was like this. He trained for a very long time, but still had a very strong ego. We once held a meeting of 30 priests at the monastery. As head abbot, I sat in the uppermost seat. The priests were arranged by age. If two priests were the same age, they were seated according to years of training. The priest in question arrived late. If he'd been on time, he would have been just 3 seats away from me. But since he arrived late, he took the further seat. At first, he said nothing. Then we had a meal and a little sake. Finally, he stood up in front of everyone and angrily complained about having to sit in the furthest seat. The other priest scolded him, saying that all his time in the monastery hadn't gotten rid of one iota of his egotism. He's actually a good temple priest, but he has a very strong ego. One of the other priests at the meeting told me how upset they all were that their colleague was so self-centered, and suggested that as head abbot I should say something to him. I refused. I said it wouldn't help. until he realized for himself what a strong ego he had, there was no point in me saying anything about it. There was nothing to be done. I said we would just have to wait until he died. Such cases occur when a monk doesn't get adequate training under a good master. And this underscores the importance of allowing ourselves to actually experience these moments where we realize we're acting in a less than optimal way. And I don't mean optimal in terms of regular way society thinks about it. I'm talking about optimal in terms of not being dysfunctional. Optimal in terms of being let go and truly present and expressing through compassion and wisdom instead of through attachment and ego. It's vital that when these things come up for us, that we don't shove them under the carpet, that we don't try to force them back in their boxes, because they will drive us. Subconsciously, they will drive us. And we'll still continue dysfunctional behavior. We just won't be realizing what we're doing because we have tried to ignore it. So take advantage of it. If any of these things come up for you, tune in. See it clearly. Feel the remorse and the regret for ever having acted in that way. And vow to let it go. And something good comes of this, because the next time the habit pattern would come forth and you would be inclined to react in that same way, it's almost as if some blinking light comes out of the woodwork and says, wait a minute, do you really want to do this again or not? It gives you a chance not to do it. And it's very easy not to do it. If we have truly tuned in when the awareness of it came up the first time and let it go as a result, we can't make ourselves let go something. We can't try to let go something. It sort of has to happen through a deeper level. We can make all the New Year's resolutions in the world, and it's classic that by the mid-February of each new year, most of the resolutions people have made have gone out the window. But when we see them as clearly as we see them, as we're doing our deep practice, it's easy. And it's important. Zen is about living authentically, truly present with what is in each moment. And when we are clear and not caught in our ideas about things, we're able to respond in that moment with that innate compassion and wisdom, rather than reacting to it out of our need to protect a self-ego. The same stubborn egotism applies in lay life. I would tell you a story about an old lady who lives near my monastery. She's come to every public meditation session and has attended many of my lectures since I became Zen master there. I sometimes run into her in the neighborhood. At one such encounter, she told me about a woman living across the street from her who didn't like her and had never greeted her. And oh my goodness, we can get such ideas about things like that. The other woman may not have greeted her the first time because she was so absorbed in some concern that had her completely tied up mentally, emotionally, and wasn't really aware that the neighbor was there. And then when the neighbor didn't say hello because she assumed that the first woman was angry at her or didn't like her, then that it snowballed. And for many years, how long was it? Um, 20 years or something like that, that they would occasionally have encounters and never say hello to each other. You've been listening to these lectures for a long time, I advise her. Enter a state of empty mind. You must be able to greet anyone, including this woman across the street. The old lady said she tried saying hello, but got no response. She said that when the woman left her house across the street in the morning, she would always look away, so that it was really impossible to greet her. I slapped her on the back and said, "You just have to do it." Why did the other woman look away? Probably she had ideas about things. Probably she thought the woman questioned didn't like her. It's amazing the assumptions we can come up with without having a reality check on it. The next day she phoned to say that she'd done it. It's been 20 years since I said hello to the lady across the street. I saw her this morning and said, "Good morning," in a loud voice. She was so happy, her face lit up, and she said, "Good morning," right back. This is what the old lady told me over the phone. She said, "Good morning," in a loud voice. Maybe the lady across the street couldn't hear very well and didn't even realize that the one in question had asked her or had said good morning to her before, because she hadn't said it in a loud enough voice. In Japan, you don't really talk in a loud voice. I had a rather an impromptu lesson in that when I was downtown and getting on a bus ready to go back to the temple. And of course, there was never a lot of time, so you had to get back to the temple before the evening sitting. Actually, you had to get it before supper, because everyone was required to be back at the temple by supper. The Roshi was personally responsible for every person training at the temple. And so these rules were meant to be able to keep track of people. And so the bus station had a number of different buses. I learned which stall the bus to Sogenji that would drop me at the head of the street that led right up to Sogenji would park at. But what I also learned was that there were a couple of other buses that went, started out in that direction, but then veered off. I found that out the hard way when suddenly the bus I was riding on turned right and went up a hill, a very tall hill, and I was not able to get off it until an official bus stop at the top of this long, tall hill. So I had to get off and walk all the way down the hill and walk further up the main road to where I would be able to get the bus to that would stop in front of Sogenji, for sure, hopefully. So having had that experience, each time I would get on a bus, I would quietly go up to the front of the bus, because you enter buses from the back door in Japan, and ask the driver if he was going to stop at Sogenji. And usually I got an affirmative. In this case, I was a little bit late getting on the bus, and it was already filled with people, so I knew it would take off in a minute. And I wasn't sure I would have time to get up quietly and say something to the driver, and it was going to cost me almost $3 just to get off at the next bus stop. And I didn't have that kind of money. So from the back of the bus, I called out to the driver and asked if he was going to stop at Sogenji, and every single head in the bus turned around. Who was this shocking foreigner who was so loud and obnoxious? So this may have been what was going on for this elderly lady across the street. Maybe she didn't hear very well. And maybe that's why she didn't respond the first time the other woman called out to her. And then, of course, when the other woman ignored her, she figured that the woman didn't like her, and so she turned her head away each time. And as I said, it's amazing the ideas we can get about each other. based on our assumptions. It really, we can cause ourselves no manner of suffering as a result of this. We jump to such conclusions about what the other person is thinking about us, or what the other person, why the other person did this, and so on and so forth. This is why it's so essential to become as clear and let go as possible, so that you're not walking into a situation or a relationship with a bunch of ideas about yourself, about your history, that are coloring your assumptions about the relationship. Zen practice is about becoming so totally free that we can naturally respond appropriately in every single situation. We're not caught on whether we're being insulted, or whether somebody doesn't like us, or any of many other things that can run through our minds. Zen practice offers us true freedom, freedom from the tyranny of the ego, so that we can live fully, willing to take risks in order to live fully. We're not just skimming across the surface of life, afraid to get hurt, turning away from certain things because we have ideas about them, when those ideas are simply born of our conditioning and our assumptions about our lives and ourselves and perhaps the other people involved. To dive in, allowing ourselves to experience the felt sense of whatever sensations might arise, but with our main focus being this wordless search. Who are we really? We begin to realize that we're not who we thought we were. And that's actually a rather important piece of practice. It can be a real turning point, because then we're really more willing to not be so attached to our ideas. And we continue on, and we continue on, and we continue on, and we continue on. And we have a kensho. And we can choose to work on subsequent koans, which expand and deepen that in a certain way. Or we can continue with the sasokan, the extended out-breath, searching more deeply, more broadly, independently of koans. Either way, it's important to continue on. One kensho is not sufficient to make us home free. It is certainly sufficient to make a difference in our lives, but as Kala Rinpoche used to say, it's like a flash of lightning in a dark night. You're walking up a mountain path on a moonless night, feeling your way along. This is how the early Zen practice is. We really are going blindly along. And then there's a flash of lightning, and suddenly the landscape is lit up. Now you can see the path ahead of you, briefly. But it's different now, because you can see something ahead of you. You can see where you're going. So keep on practicing, everyone. Keep working as hard as you've been working, and even harder. Focus, with greater determination. Dare to let go. Dare to become this experience of the out-breath. Dare to let go the guard in the sentry house. Great good will come from it. So on this fifth day, as I said at the beginning, you've done a lot of hard work already, and your capacity has grown. So you can go even deeper, much deeper, by an order of magnitude. Take advantage of that. You won't regret it. Now, thank you for listening. We'll stop now. Recite the four vows.